This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 27th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Robert Bound. Hours before the Olympic opening ceremony, Midori House catches Olympic fever. Coming up first, we hear from Rio's mayor, Eduardo Paes, who's getting ready to take the Olympic baton from London.
We'll have the briefing in Rio, seeing what went wrong, what went fine. So we're going to still keep working with people from London to help us during the Olympics in Rio. So there's lots of collaboration.
We also go to the Olympic Stadium live to hear from our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. And Panjan drum of pop punditry, Paul Morley, joins us to discuss this year's crop of Olympic anthems and a classic from Barcelona's games.
Barcelona! Barcelona!
How can you follow that? Well, later in the show, our senior editor Sophie Grove tells us why the Olympics means opportunity for politicians as well as sportsmen.
As leaders battle to hammer out resolutions at the Security Council and secure yet more bailouts in Brussels, the Games provide a soft power opportunity for them to firm up alliances and make strong symbolic gestures.
All that, plus we'll play a couple of cracking tracks, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, it's news time with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The United States has today warned of a massacre in the Syrian city of Aleppo after President Bashar al-Assad's forces launched ground and air bombardments in preparation for a major onslaught against rebels there. Insurgents have targeted army roadblocks and security installations, with both sides avoiding close warfare in the northern city. The US State Department said credible reports of tank columns moving on Aleppo, along with airstrikes by helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft, represented a serious escalation of President al-Assad's efforts to crush a rebellion that began 16 months ago. In other developments, two photographers who were taken hostage last week by al-Qaeda-linked militants in northern Syria have been released, according to the Netherlands Association for Journalists. The Dutchman Jeroen Eurlemans and his British colleague John Cantley were captured on July the 17th while working near the Syrian border with Turkey. The Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras is meeting international creditors to try to persuade them that his government deserves its final instalment of bailout money. The EU, IMF and European Central Bank are studying Greece's finances before deciding whether to hand over 31.5 billion euros. Analysts warn that without the funds, Greece would face bankruptcy and probably leave the euro. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said Greece was a part of the European family and must stay that way, but it also must deliver on its reforms.
The key word here is deliver. Deliver, deliver, deliver. The main issue is implementation to deliver results. To maintain the trust of European and international partners, the delays must end. Words are not enough. Actions are much more important.
Spain's Deputy Prime Minister Soraya Sáenz de Santamaría has said the country would not seek a full-scale bailout from the Eurozone to help it avoid defaulting on its debts. The announcement comes despite earlier reports that European officials said it may be a possibility. The UK's Health Protection Agency has warned that an outbreak of whooping cough in England and Wales has spread to very young babies. The agency says these are most at risk of severe complications and death. There were another 675 cases in June, bringing the total for 2012 so far to 2,466. The United Nations Command and South Korea have held a ceremony to mark the 59th anniversary of armistice after the Korean War. The armistice agreement among North Korea, China and the United States was made in 1953 at Panmunjom in the demilitarized zone dividing North and South Korea. James Thurman, commander of the US Forces Korea, said the armistice status on the Korean Peninsula has been successful.
This is a powerful message of the hard work, the dedication and education of our great ally. This is a true success story when you have peace and stability so people can perform and have security so they may continue to improve their nation.
Olympic fans in London have been left confused and angry on Friday after they turned up at the famous Lord's Cricket Ground for the archery preliminaries, only to be told the event was closed to the public. The mix-up occurred after the event was listed as unticketed in some official brochures, leading some fans and ticketing websites to believe it was a free event open to the public on the day. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 5 minutes past 6 p.m. in London, and you're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24. You're back with Midori House. I'm Robert Bound. We're coming to you live from Studio One in London. The London Olympics may not yet have started, not quite yet, but for Brazil, the countdown to their Olympics in 2016 has already begun. Rio's mayor, Eduardo Paes, is currently in London to view the Games and perhaps get some tips along the way. Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and our editor, Andrew Tuck, went to meet with him and hear how London's welcomed him.
Have you ever been to Disney World? I mean, when all the employees there... People tell them, you got to smile, you got to be nice to tourists. It's amazing what's happening here. I mean, usually Londoners are nice people, but at this time, I mean, I feel like I'm at Disney World. Everyone is so, you know, how are you this morning? Welcome to London. What are you doing here? Where are you from?
I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the sun was out. The good thing is that the sun is out most of the time in Rio, and I think smiles come naturally, because had you been here probably a week ago, it was horrendous. You know, we've had 3 months of rain, so I think it's also, I mean, weather does play such a huge part in the mood of the whole thing. I wanted to ask you, I mean, do you feel that when you're going around at the moment, you're just benchmarking and looking at everything and just seeing how everything is done? Is it sort of, you know, making your brain collapse and figuring out, okay, what are we going to do different, or we need to copy this?
I mean, usually people are much more looking to the mistakes than to the good things that are happening. I mean, obviously we're watching the good things, but we are trying to pay attention what are the mistakes. The first thing I realized, I mean, I got here yesterday, but the first thing I really did realize was that, I mean, you are not going to put a bunch of visitors, millions of visitors, and have a big event like the Olympics, and the city will see what happens to the city. First thing you realize, it's like traffic, lots of traffic. And there's no way you can get rid of traffic. So, it's from a certain perspective, it's interesting to see what's happening to London. I mean, it's a much more developed city than Rio, obviously, but it's interesting to see that. I mean, you're not going to get like paradise, you know? I mean, London is being like London is. I mean, a nice city with lots of people, packed with people, exciting city. So the real big difference that you see from the everyday life of London is more and more tourists everywhere, gringos everywhere, and the mood is up there. So, I mean, but this is pretty much the same. But obviously, we're looking. We have a bunch of people here looking to what's happening, and I mean, to get the good things that you're doing, and not repeat the mistakes. But mainly, I mean, we want to do better games than you guys are doing. So, I mean, at least follow the British punctuality.
Can I ask you that when we see these games taking place, we normally think of cities, actually, as you say, being slightly rivals. But actually, behind the scenes, is there a huge amount of collaboration between, say, London and Rio? Are they giving you advice on actually where they did go wrong and things that they think you should be careful about?
I mean, this has been happening. I'd say since the bid in 2009, when Rio was against Chicago, Madrid, and Tokyo, I mean, you really could see that the guys from London, they were, you know, really wanting Rio to win the bid. And since the first day we won the bid, I mean, I was in London just like 2-3 weeks after we won the bid, and it's been lots of collaboration. I mean, Mayor Boris Johnson is helping a lot. I'm just scared what he's going to do with the flag. I mean, he might do something crazy. And Sebastian Coe is helping a lot. The ODA is helping a lot. So, I mean, we've been having lots of collaboration. And that will keep, because we'll have, I think it's in November, we'll have a debriefing in Rio. So seeing what went wrong, what went fine. So we're going to still keep working with people from London to help us during the Olympics in Rio. So there's lots of collaboration.
From a geographical perspective, you have both, of course, you know, the beauty and the majesty of mountains and extraordinary geography, which is unbeatable. How much of it is also a hindrance as well, just as you've been sort of thinking about planning out how the games are going to be structured? Because, you know, they're your sort of greatest masterpiece, but the other side as well, do they throw up quite a few challenges for you?
Yeah, I mean, the real games are very spread around city. I mean, it's first time that all the games, all the competitions are going to be in the territory of the city. I mean, this has never, ever happened to Olympic Games. I mean, for instance, I mean, you come to London, there's no ocean, so you got to do the sailing out of London. In Rio, everything's going to be in Rio. And the purpose of our bid was we want to spread that around town. So it's like we have four clusters. Two of the clusters are in the wealthy area of the city, in the nicest areas, the well-known areas of the city, like Copacabana, Ipanema, and the, close to Sugarloaf and Corcovado. And the other clusters are in the poorest areas of the city. So this is what we want for the games in Rio. I mean, it's a game about legacy, what is going to be left by the end of the day. And I think, in spite of the fact that London is in another level of development, the London Games already did, I mean, we're starting tonight, but already did something great to the city. Was the only area you had in terrible shape. You guys got it right now. So, I mean, I think every time more and more Olympic Games are connected to legacy, you know, to what's going to be left to the city by the end of the day.
Can I just ask you on that legacy question? One of the big issues, of course, for Brazil and for Rio is security. And your sports minister was quoted yesterday as saying that he felt that that was still an issue that Rio had to tackle. Is that something that you also want to be a legacy of the Games, that there's a way in which Rio will change almost a little bit socially as well?
Again, I mean, I don't worry about security for the Games. I mean, Rio has been having lots of big events. Obviously not as big as the Olympics, but lots of big events in the history of the city, and we had never have a major problem with security. What we care about security is our everyday life, but when you talk about the Olympics, it's like you get this big event, and you say this is going to be a reason to change lots of things. So I nowadays use the Olympics for everything. I mean, it's an excuse to do everything that I think the city needs. So it's like when you talk about Olympic, you talk about, you know, breaking a record, you know, jumping a wall and changing things. So what we try to do is that. I mean, use the Olympics to make things change in the city. Even the security issues that we're facing, it's much better now than it was a few years ago, but we still got a long way to go. So, I mean, we're using a lot of the Olympics to change things in Rio, but really not necessarily connected to the event. You know, like most of the transportation that we are doing, they're not necessarily for the games. I mean, I don't know, the tourists are going to use it, the athletes are going to use it, but it's going to be great for the city.
I think that's an interesting point, because you reference all of the good work that's been done out in the East End of London. I think one of the question marks we have looking around London at the moment is, okay, when the circus leaves town, what's really going to be left for all Londoners? So you have this one contained part of the city, and I've been looking around thinking, even from a sports point of view, you know, new parks, you know, did someone think of a whole new, you know, bike lane system and everything? So it would be interesting to see, and are you really sort of thinking about how can you touch the lives of all kinds of people, whether you live in, you know, in Leblon, whether you live in an emerging neighborhood, whether you live in a favela, that there are going to be things that really almost glue the city together, because I think what we don't have in London right now is the glue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make, I would like to make a few comments on London, but first I'll talk about Rio. Again, this is going to be spread all over town. I mean, it's easier for us in that aspect to get things done, because, I mean, the city's in a different, again, level of development than London is. So this is, we're going to have a big glue because of this four cluster spread around the city. But let me make a comment on London. I mean, there is always this tangible legacies, but there are these non-tangible legacies. I mean, there are two big cities, two great, great big cities in the world these days. I mean, it's because of the language, it's because of lots of stuff, but it's London and New York. I mean, these are the two, like, I think these two cities, they are, which one of them is the capital of the world? And I mean, obviously, there are advantages in each side. I don't say it's a dispute, but it is. And I think the Londoners have to realize that when you bring the Olympics, it's like you consolidate the position of the capital of the world. I mean, of a country, of a developed city with great people, but especially that accepts everyone. So the Olympics has lots to do with, you know, welcoming everyone. It doesn't matter what race, what religion, what's your sex option or what you're going to do. I mean, this is London. So, I mean, I think you consolidate. This is a non-tangible legacy for the game. So this is the big glue for London. I mean, we feel at home here. I mean, it's very comfortable for all of us to come to London and say, okay, we're home. It's a very comfortable city.
There's so many Brazilians here. I mean, there's more Brazilians than anywhere else in the world, I think. So, of course, you feel comfortable.
That's it. And that's good that you guys accept us very well. So, I mean, this is how it is. This is the good part of it. It's going to be a long legacy. You feel it in the history of London.
For the soft power of Brazil, there's nothing more important than this event. Is there a lot of influence coming from central government as well? Are you being allowed to run the show, or is this actually really a whole national effort?
I think it's a national effort. I mean, I see these big events, World Cup, Olympics, as geopolitical decisions. I mean, if you go to history, you're going to see when they go to China, when they go to Seoul, Korea, when they go to Spain, when it's consolidated for integrating the European Union, when you see the World Cup going to Africa, to South Africa. So I think it was kind of a geopolitical decision, you know. It's a time for countries like Brazil to develop. It's our chance. Our soft power is a different environment. So I really do believe that that's a national thing. Obviously, Rio has always been the international face of Brazil for its good things and for its problems. So, I mean, it's a national thing.
And can you just tell us what you'll be doing tonight? Will you be at the opening ceremony?
Yeah, I'll be there. But I'm excited for the closing ceremony, I mean, because then it's when I get the flag, when we become the Olympic city. I mean, I'm really, really looking forward for good things good to happen good in London. But, you know, I want to come and pick up the flag, say goodbye, bye-bye, London, and come to Rio in 2016. That's my time.
Eduardo Paes, thank you very much.
And that was Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Tyler Relay talking with Rio's Mayor Paes. And you're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we cross over live to the Olympic Stadium to check in with our editor-in-chief again, Tyler Relay.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the latest edition of The Menu, we discover the Chinese delicacies you don't yet find from restaurants, but soon might. And if you want something exotic and something European at the same time, what would you say about fruits such as carambolas, passion fruits, pepinos, guavas, and so on, all grown in Croatia? We also get another example on how to appreciate local food more as we visit a great Lisbon restaurant that does what so many other Portuguese restaurants don't, that is to specialize on local fish.
A big part of our concept is quality.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You are tuned into Midori House live from London. Now we're going to cross over to the Olympic Stadium, where Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Relay sits eagerly awaiting the opening ceremony. Hi, Tyler.
Hello, Robert.
I want to first ask you how you got there. Were you whisked down an Olympic lane?
Well, it's quite curious. We were whisked down many Olympic lanes. We started our journey in a rather toasty coach in front of the Dorchester, and it was pretty smooth sailing all the way through London until you get quite close to the venue, about maybe 2 kilometres away, and then, oddly, the Olympic lanes end. And so we spent a little bit of time in traffic. But I have to say, The streets of London are actually quite empty. I think all of the hype and scare that has gone into the traffic crush has really kept people off the roads.
And what was the atmosphere like on the kind of Olympic battle bus on the way? I mean, there's a lot of cool people with many an arched eyebrow, I guess, at the Olympics. But I guess there was also a sense of real genuine excitement now.
Yeah, there was a sense of excitement, but I think more just people wanting to get here. And there was a sort of dread as well of how long is it going to take. And in fact, it wasn't all that bad. It was probably... you know, from the center of London, took us about an hour right now. I'm standing in front of the hospitality pavilion, which is more like a hospitality city. You have various fiefdoms, a big show of force of major corporate signs. Carlos Ghosn, the head of Nissan, Renault, just walked by in front of me. I just saw Ian Thorpe go by on a small golf buggy. Anyway, so... people are sort of gathering here for the next few hours at the hospitality center, and there's a railway in between the hospitality center and the main stadium, but this will be the staging area for the next few hours anyway.
So you're in a sort of classy holding pen at the moment.
It's a classy holding pen. We weren't quite sure what room they were going to whisk us into, but that has been sorted and found, and I see people drinking nice beverages, so hopefully we'll do that quite soon.
Yeah, you'll be washing down your Big Mac with a can of Heineken bought with a Visa card, presumably.
Well, and great segue, because I'm looking across at what we're told is the world's biggest McDonald's. And I have to say, it is one of the finest structures at the Olympic Park. It's this wonderful wooden affair, which would not look out of place on the slope somewhere in the Engadine Valley.
And what's the sort of dress code for something like this? Are people dressed up? Are they dressed, presuming that the rain that's promised in Danny Boyle's opening ceremony doesn't get on their feet? Or are you yourself sporting a purple Olympic tracksuit?
Well, Rob, much to my dismay, there's a lot of purple on show here. Purple and red being seemingly the official colours for all staff here. It's a tricky one, because if you're a CEO or a captain of industry and you get this rather elaborate email talking about average temperatures and what might happen with the weather, it's very complicated. So there's a lot of very tricky footwear on a lot of gentlemen, a lot of very hot executives, many a gentleman with sweaty patches around their boob line.
I've seen, watching in the office, we've obviously had all the live rolling news channels, and I think the BBC need to possibly put some more foundation on some of their lead anchors from the Olympic Stadium. There's been a lot of sort of sweat, or maybe there's an air conditioning fault generally in the Olympic Park side. It's something that probably doesn't go down as well as a purple tracksuit.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the BBC, because they have one of the more curious broadcast sites. Many of the main international networks seem to be on site. There is a large container arrangement of blue containers. I would imagine it's NBC. I can't confirm it, but it's a very slick-looking operation. But then off in the distance, on a not particularly attractive tower block, council tower block, you have this white BBC pod. Which is quite strange, because it really feels it's not part of the village, which is odd. It's really off in the distance. Of course, they've got a great venue, but as you're saying, you know, no point having a great venue. Oh, here comes the Scottish team. No, I'm kidding. But I'm actually being chased by a bagpiper. I am not. Joking. I'm going to try to move somewhere else. But
this is good. I think this is the beauty of live.
Now there's a battalion of girl guides in front of me. I'm not sure what they're going to get up to. They might thrust a biscuit my way.
I wanted to ask you what the sort of sense of purpose is, or the sense of expectation is when you're rocking up to a ceremony. It's kind of not a pop concert purely, and it's not like a sporting event either. It's sort of somewhere sort of between the two. Is there a kind of, like, I suppose there's a sort of general expectation of what people are going to see, but there's not kind of a proper behaviour for it, is there?
No, because and because you don't really practice it for this on a yearly event. It only happens every 4 years. So yeah, people don't know quite what to do. If I'm looking around right now, here comes that bloody bagpiper again. I think they're going to send him off to, I think he's going off to Westfield.
Okay.
But... yeah, people are. You know, some people are in sun loungers, and many others are just sort of parked out. you see a lot of people obviously texting and writing emails. Many a busy iPhone and BlackBerry here as well. What is curious, though, is just the show of faces, and it's a very Caucasian affair, which is quite surprising. You would think that there would be lots of visitors from the Middle East, and there would be, from all over the world, but maybe it's just because, well, even being in London's not an excuse, it's a major international event, and that's actually one of the most striking things when I look around at the moment.
All right, Tyler. Well, we'll let you chase off that bagpiper and tuck into some of the goodies in the Olympic Park. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy the ceremony tonight. We'll probably catch up with you perhaps later on.
We'll be chatting later on. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Tyler. And that was Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulet, and there will be extensive coverage, as we mentioned, of the opening ceremony in our three-hour special edition of tonight's Monocle Daily. For the time being, though, you're tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24. It's 1826 here in London. It should be conceded up front that in an event the size of an Olympic Games, there are a billion things that could go wrong. So nobody should be blamed unduly when a few things do. That said, of all the things you'd check and triple check, it would not be getting North and South Korea muddled. This was, of course, exactly what happened this week when the women's football team of the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea were fanfared onto Glasgow's Hampden Park with the flag of the capitalist running dog Republic of South Korea. The North Koreans stalked off in a huff before emerging an hour or so later to exact a 2-0 revenge over Colombia. But it's not like it was the first time such a mix-up had occurred. Lots of countries have similar names and similar-looking flags. Earlier this week, Charles Ashburner from the General Flag Institute, and there is such a thing, joined us to talk a little more about this.
Charles, do you think the North Koreans overreacted yesterday?
No, I don't. I think it's... I think what we've got to remember in situations like these is it's not what the people of Britain think is important. We're supposed to be catering here for people from all over the world, and we're supposed to be making sure that things that are sensitive to them are dealt with properly. And getting something as obvious as that wrong, quite honestly, makes it look like we don't really care.
You say it's a very obvious mistake to make, and I think most of us would agree with you on that point, but how often does this kind of thing actually happen?
Far too often, really. I think people assume that flags is a sort of simple, perhaps pub quiz type subject, and they don't realise how little they know. There's a situation happened that hasn't really been reported in the press in Regent Street today, yesterday and today, where they originally they put the flag of Taiwan up amongst the flags of the competing nations, and were asked, probably none too politely by the Chinese, to take the flag down, because, of course, to the Chinese, Taiwan is just a rebel province. And so I believe now that they either have or they're about to put the flag of Chinese Taipei up instead, which is the flag that Taiwan have to compete under.
I would imagine that request from China was exceedingly brisk. I mean, I come from Australia, and obviously, as I'm sure you know, we have a flag which often gets muddled up with the not dissimilar flag of New Zealand. But what are some other common mix-ups of similar-looking flags?
Ivory Coast and Ireland is an obvious one. Even something like France and Holland, which if you put them, if you just tilt them 90 degrees, they look very similar. There are endless variations of things that can be done wrong. But also, it's about, you mentioned Wikipedia earlier in your piece. Somebody looking up a flag on Wikipedia is not guaranteed to get an accurate answer because, for example, the number of stars on a flag might have changed. All manner of things do, you know, change as time goes on, and it's very difficult to get it right.
I mean, arguably, you said time goes on, but flags are the original example of great branding. What makes a good flag?
I think that something which is instantly recognisable is probably the answer, and I think that's why the flag of the United Kingdom, the Union flag, is a world beater amongst flags, because it's very, very hard to mistake it for something else.
It gets flown upside down quite a lot, though, doesn't it?
It does, usually by the people who should know better, namely prime ministers have a real habit for doing that. John Major did it. I can remember a number of press conferences with Tony Blair, where he was talking to the world from his podium, and behind him was an upside-down Union flag. So yes, I think that's a factor caused by the fact that we don't educate our children in any way about our national flag.
I mean, are there some flags that you personally have particular regard for because they are so distinctive that there's no chance anybody would ever mix them up with anybody else's? I mean, you say the Union Jack, but the Union Jack, of course, appears on the national flags of several other countries, Australia's and New Zealand's included.
I think probably I have a certain amount of bias here because I'm Welsh, but I think the flag of Wales has got to be one of the hardest to mix up with anything else. And it is impossible to put upside down. I don't think I've ever seen it upside down.
It'd make for a very dizzy flag, wouldn't it? And Charles, I must confess, before we end this conversation, I must ask you, I am A, fascinated by your organisation, and B, interested into how you actually got to be chair of it and why you first fell in love with flags. Because I, for one, am one of those people who would get reasonably baffled between Ivory Coast and Ireland.
Okay, well... I suppose I've been interested in flags from a very early age, and I've been making flags, a flag maker since about 1989. I'm lucky enough to do my hobby as my job, and that has developed over the years into an involvement with the Flag Institute, and gradually I've become one of the spokesmen.
And when you say you've worked on flag designs, have you worked on national or state level flags?
I'm a flag maker rather than a flag designer, okay. Though I am also a graphic designer. But the Flag Institute, as an organisation, does indeed design flags for all manner of things. For example, the country Tristan da Cunha, a little known place in the South Atlantic, where the mutiny of the Bounty happened. That flag was designed by the Flag Institute. Also the UK Border Agency, the Supreme Court, Royal Fleet Auxiliary, even a suggestion of a flag for Antarctic, which is broadly used around the world because in the absence of anything else.
And that was the flag fancying Charles Ashburner talking earlier in the week to Andrew Miller and Emma Nelson. In the next half an hour, Midori House, we'll be discussing Olympic anthems, and we'll be hearing if London is ready for the Games. But first, at the bottom of the hour, is James Luckhurst.
The United States has today warned of a massacre in the Syrian city of Aleppo after President Bashar Assad's forces launched ground and air bombardments in preparation for a major onslaught against rebels there. Insurgents have targeted army blockades, army roadblocks and security installations, with both sides avoiding close warfare in the northern city. Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras is meeting international creditors to try to persuade them that his government deserves its final instalment of bailout money. The EU, IMF and European Central Bank are studying Greece's finances before deciding whether to hand over 31.5 billion euros. Spain's Deputy Prime Minister Soraya Sanz de Santamaría has said the country won't be seeking a full-scale bailout from the eurozone. Those are the headlines from Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bound. Coming up next, we hear how ready London is for the Games. But before that, one of our Midori House sessions. This is Charlene Spiteri.
This is MCV1. You know this one.
20 seconds on the back tie. I feel you wrong. Cause when I get there, you know I got that feeling. I always got that feeling deep down inside. So say what you want. Oh,
and that was Say What You Want by Charlene Spiteri. And the time is, it's 18:37 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. After 7 years of build-up, oftentimes fraught, it's finally here. The London Olympic Games 2012. The flags of competing nations are flying on Regent Street. The athletes have arrived for their stay in the Olympic Village and people have their tickets at the ready as they struggle to work out how to navigate the capital's strained transport system. But how ready's ready? And what nature of extravaganza can we expect? Earlier today, former editor of Il Sole 24, Gianni Viotta, joined us in the studio.
So what do you think? Is the city awash with Olympic glow today?
The city is not ready, of course, but no city in the... This is my fourth Olympics, and no city has always been ever ready. There doesn't exist in such a thing like being ready for the Olympics. It's like being ready for a dive from the 10th-meter platform. But the city is diving, and it will be a very successful dive.
And presumably that lack of readiness actually adds to the frisson and the excitement in a way.
It's such a big event. Tonight, billions of people will watch the opening ceremony by Danny Doyle, and there will be ships brought over to the meadows. There will be people that will perform for the first time in their lives. So there is an element of tension, but this is going to be great. And I think the tension is right.
Gianni, London's very reputation is at stake, of course. It is a defining moment for us as a country. Tonight's opening ceremony, as you mentioned, is going to set the tone for the whole event, really. And we've got acclaimed Oscar-winning filmmaker Danny Boyle of Slumdog Millionaire fame at the helm. Do you think he can pull it off? We've had a few sneak previews, haven't we?
The real director of the Olympics and the opening ceremony will be the city, you were saying, and it will be London. And I have no doubt that this is the first time a city ever hosted the Olympics three times. London was 1908, 1948, and now 2012. And so I think he's right, because London was the right birthplace for modern sports. So it is right that the city has the honor of hosting the Olympic Games for the third time, and I'm positive it will be a great, great Games. And of course, people will be grumbling about the Games, Londoners will be grumbling about the Games, and tourists will be grumbling about London, and they both will love it.
Yes, true to our peculiarly British ways, there have been plenty of complaints and cynicism in the build-up, hasn't there? But it does feel like today is finally a day for national celebration, doesn't it?
It is. And I would say, like, people have been complaining because, as you know, this small shopkeeper was blamed because he did Olympic rings with sausages.
Oh,
and
I
the
know.
corporate sponsor told him not to. And I know it's not politically correct, but can I side with the sponsors, please? I mean, Olympic rings with sausages,
yes.
That was such a brilliant idea.
They need to relax,
exactly.
Don't they? Exactly. Yes, absolutely. Now, the Olympic torch is travelling on the Thames on the Royal Barge Gloria as we speak. We are pretty good as a nation at doing all that pomp and pageantry, aren't we?
Yes, and the Queen Jubilee was fantastic. But let me tell you something. When you see so many people, commoners, as they say around here, packing the streets and the pavements watching the Olympic torch, I'm a very skeptical and cynical old newspaper man. But by chance, I ran with a torch in the Winter Olympics in Turin 2006, and I cried all the way. And so if I cry, this means that these are really moving moments for everybody.
Well, there has been a degree of surprise at the number of people who've come out just to catch a glimpse of the torch. It obviously is a really powerful symbol, isn't it?
Yeah, and we media are to blame, because we see we cast, and that's a professional duty for us to cast a cynical eye on almost everything. But the people, the real people, actually enjoy. And when you talk to people that I talked to a couple of people, and athletes and ordinary people that watched or performed in the 1948 Olympics, and they are so fond of those memories. Mm. And of course, we have all seen Chariots of Fire. And because these are moments that we will always, always cherish in the future.
And living up to that historic momentum of the occasion, we've got a lovely clip of the London Mayor Boris Johnson's rather rousing and Churchillian speech that he gave last night. Let's listen to that.
I hear there's a guy called Mitt Romney. He wants to know whether we're ready. Are we ready? Are we ready? Yes, we are. The venues are ready. The stadium is ready, the aquatic centre is ready, the velodrome is ready, the security is ready, the police are ready, the transport system is ready. And our Team GB athletes are ready, aren't they?
He certainly knows how to rally the crowd, doesn't he?
My next big event after the Olympics are going to be the American presidential elections.
Ah.
And I had always little doubt that President Obama would squeak by, not win in a landslide, but squeak by. I have to say that Mr. Romney surprised me because he came here to bask in the glory of a fellow conservative.
Yes.
And Cameron was ready to give him the red carpet treatment. And instead, he really...
put his foot in it.
absolutely, because, I mean, they may not be ready, but as a host, as a guest, you are not going to say to your host, you are not ready. And the mayor was good, and Cameron was great when he said, it's easy to run an Olympics in the middle of nowhere, meaning Salt Lake City. And this statement will going to haunt Romney till November.
And what a great voice he has. That was former editor of El Sole 24, Gianni Riotta. You're listening to Midori House. Next up, we'll be discussing which Olympic songs get a footing on the medal table and which have stood the test of time. Stay tuned.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's 18:45 here in the Olympic City, and as the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics looms upon us, music writer Paul Morley thought it a good time to get his teeth into some of the standout Olympic songs written for the London Games. And yes, we do manage to squeeze in Freddie Mercury's Barcelona too. I caught up with him a little earlier to help dish out the musical medals. Paul, you're with us this evening to talk about the Olympic tracks. It's sort of the rave Olympics, because the first track we're going to hear from and talk about is from the Chemical Brothers.
Yeah, you can really see the generational thing, actually, can't you? It's quite interesting. You know, for my generation, it would be the closing end of things with the Blur and the New Orders and the Specials, and then this generation has got this and the bright colours of the uniforms. It does have that quality, doesn't it?
There's a sort of, yeah, luminous boiler house,
yeah,
rave.
Yeah, definitely. You see the headbands around Johnson and Co. and Cameron, you know, glowing in the dark.
I think, first of all, we'll start with the Chemical Brothers track, and this is called Velodrome. And that is Velodrome from Chemical Brothers. Paul, I feel like I'm being sort of chased around a futuristic film set by a sort of angry cyborg.
Yeah, it's definitely got the idea that the next few weeks will be like a film, and that is definitely the beginning credits, isn't it? So I quite like the fact they've reduced the lyrics to just, you know, Velodrome. I think, you know, it, not only does the music sound like they've just flicked a couple of switches, but it also...
We have to get more syllables in it than Elton John would.
But it's just like, it does feel that they've just switched on the plug-in that says Kraftwerk and basically just taken three syllables. So they've not gone for the anthemic element. It's very abstract, isn't it? I quite like that one in the
sense
that...
It sounds like it was going somewhere.
It's an anti-anthem as well. And it's so meticulously designed for what it's for, which is the... I mean, it's almost too perfect, isn't it? It's exactly what it says on the plugin.
Next, we're going to have Elton John versus Panau, as I said it when I was calling it out to our producer, do you think it's got a silent P? They now.
Yeah, it might be Canal. You never know. They really want to trip us up there, don't they?
Yeah. And these are the Aussie guys. I think Elton John's been working with. I think they're on Mercury Records
Yeah, on his, I think his management company as well. He's taken a close personal interest in them, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hear it. This is Elton John versus Panau, or Now, and this is Good Morning to the Night. Morning to the Night, that's Elton John versus Panau. And that album is at number one in the UK this week. First Elton John, I'm doing annoying quote marks with my fingers, album in 22 years at number one.
Yes, it is interesting that early 70s Elton John actually sounds better done in that synthetic way with the auto-tuning. It's almost like Elton John songs from that era were waiting for this level of technology that could make it sound so synthetic. It's also interesting in that sense that a lot of the Olympic iconography is animated, it's stretched characters, it's not the human thing, it's these kind of Lloyd's Banks, you know, the sort of weird... sort of turning human characters into creatures. And that's definitely music for that, isn't it? That synthetic otherworldliness. It's not human, in a way. That's not human Elton.
It's not robotic.
Elton.
You're right. It's a funny thing, isn't it? And I was kind of wondering about it. I was kind of thinking, with the Greyhill one, I mean, I know that album really well, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And that seems strangely like, obviously, they've messed around with his vocals and the rest of it, stretched it, layered it to go over the synths and the effects and all the rest of it. And it sounds to me very handsome. I think it's sort of a deserved thing. We've listened to Elton John versus Panau and the Chemical Brothers. We decided they were sort of both had anthemic qualities.
Cautiously anthemic.
All right, cautiously. Yes. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't lay all my cards on the table because we've still got four more tracks to go.
Yeah, we're building up.
This is a UK band. They're called Delphic, and this is Good Life. From Manchester, Delphic, and that is A Good Life. Paul, that sounds kind of... They were spiking in that, weren't they?
Yes, it's interesting, that idea. That's the anthem for... generic anthem, that was. An anthem for nothing in particular, but we're going to have a good time. And everybody... It's interesting, the democratic idea of a lot of these as well, which is slightly unfortunate. There's nobody made that big, bold decision of just the one.
We... Yeah.
So, you know, the lot of inclusiveness and a lot of different sorts of groups doing an anthem. And that one's sort of in the back of the crowd slightly, that one.
Without further ado, we're going to go to the none more histrionic Muse. And this is called Survival.
Pull ahead.
And that was Survival by Muse.
Yes. Well, I do find some of the elements of the Olympics, because of the way that they're using the five rings, there's a slight totalitarian underpinning to it, you know, and you look at the source of that logo and the torch, which is Nazi iconography. We can't get away from it.
Yeah.
And once you do combine that with the more corporate end of this Olympics, it does have something a little bit chilling. So I quite like the element of that song, having not, it's sort of not Wagnerian to it. It's almost Gilbert and Sullivan in a funny sort of way, but with a Wagnerian edge to it. And the idea that they are our leading pomp brand, it seems somehow fitting that they should be supplying the anthems to what has a faintly Disney-fied but nonetheless still existing totalitarian air to it.
I think there's only one person that we can end this this section of the show on, Paul. Freddie Mercury and Montserrat Caballé.
What we want all along, really.
Barcelona has been re-released in time for the Olympics. Take it away.
Barcelona! Barcelona! Barcelona, Barcelona, ooh. Viva!
And that was journalist Paul Morley and I talking earlier, not singing Barcelona, although I think actually Monocle's Olympics coverage could quite easily stretch to just simply playing Barcelona by Freddie Mercury and Montserrat Caballé on loop. You're tuned in to Midori House. Now, to finish off our Olympics show, this is our senior editor, Sophie Grove, telling us why the Olympics mean opportunity for politicians as well as sportsmen.
As athletes limber up to start the London Olympic Games and director Danny Boyle puts the finishing touches to his pastoral-themed opening ceremony, there's another tranche of players gearing up for the Games. They're a little less lithe, not nearly as toned, but every bit as competitive as the Olympians themselves. The diplomats and the premiers of the world are also using the sporting jamboree to their advantage. London is pulsing with convoys of sleek, dark black cars, choppers and even Zetas, which hover and hum above the city on high alert. 120 leaders are thought to turn out this evening for the opening ceremony. They are all here to sit trackside, poolside and pitchside and cheer on their nation's finest athletes. The savvy among them will of course do a little bit of negotiation while they're at it. As we know, the Olympics are about sport, but they are also wildly political too. And these games have come at a particularly pertinent time. As leaders battle to hammer out resolutions at the Security Council and secure yet more bailouts in Brussels, the games provide a soft power opportunity for them to firm up alliances and make strong symbolic gestures. The eyes of the world are in London, supposedly watching sporting history, but they are also keenly observing events. Our politicians are in a microcosm playing a global power of high-level chess. The games are also a discreet time for chats and all-important rapport building. What better time for Germany's Angela Merkel to have quiet words with Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda than during a spot of Olympic shot put or pigeon shooting? Or for Vladimir Putin, if he comes, to consult his pal China on how they can really dig their heels in at the UN on a Chapter 7 veto on Syria. Meanwhile, their most agile gymnasts perform gravity-defying acts of balance and skill. What better distraction? Of course, there are serious benefits to playing host. One nation that's reaping the benefits is the beleaguered UK. As its politicians contemplate one of the most sustained double-dip recessions in history, it's also on a bilateral meeting marathon with the world's most ascendant economies. Under the guise of talking basketball, footy and synchronised swimming, Cameron has already met with Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff. The two posed for photographs on the steps of number 10. Cameron is certainly making the most of the heavyweights in town. He is to hold 17 summits in London over the next month as the government tries to raise at least $1 billion of inward investment for the UK. He even took time to meet Mitt Romney, who's in town with his wife Anne, who, incidentally, co-owns a dressage horse named Raffalica, which will be competing in the equestrian competitions in Greenwich Park. So the biggest soft power event in history begins. London is a fulcrum of power. And unlike the Chinese Olympics in 2008, which streamlined, controlled, orchestrated and censored, these games will be a celebration of social democracy. Expect protests, debate, nuance, passion, conviction and foibles. Oh, and expect some sport too. I've heard it's going to be rather good. For Monocle, I'm Sophie Grove.
Thanks, Sophie. That's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. Thank you to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Tommy Hammond. Up after the news, it's this week's edition of The Menu. Today, we discover the Chinese delicacies you don't yet find in the restaurants, but soon might. That's what they say here. In 2 hours' time, it's the main event at 2100 hours here in London. Emma Nelson and Andrew Merlo will be back for a special three-hour edition of The Monocle Daily, covering the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. Midori House will be back on Monday. But for now, thanks for tuning in.